Hey, Hot Sheet is here. Scotty Braun and Baseball America's JJ Cooper and Jacob Rudner with me right now to run through quite a bit of news today. And at the top here, since we won't have time for it, but lucky for you, you probably have a Baseball America subscription. You can read about this. JJ, the A's top 10 prospects list is out now with some interesting names.
Leo DeVries, obviously top of the list. I would just say about this A's list. Now, when we talk about the A's, obviously there's Nick Kurtz, there's Jacob Wilson. This is a pretty good top 10 here too. And it's not just DeVries who they added in trade. You look at what the A's are doing right now, and for all, and I do mean all of the problems of the last couple of years, it's hard not to be a little bit encouraged by the young team that they're building here if they can work out all their other stadium issues and all that. But the talent is definitely ticking up.
Yes, it's going to be a slog through Sacramento, it seems, but there is a light at the end.
I do have a note on that. Sacramento, that's our MILB executive of the year, is the GM of Sacramento. Most startling fact I learned from that. They used the same field all year. They never needed to resaw the entire season. That blew me away.
Wow, that's incredible. That's either, I mean, shout out really to both the grounds crew, but then also whatever they put down there. I mean, it works, right? We see plenty of fields get all beat up, and the fact that they just rolled with one the whole year and it was getting almost double the action, that's impressive. Hey, let's hit first move. Meep, meep. JJ, as much as I want to talk Rule 5 draft with my favorite guy to talk Rule 5 draft with, we're going to go mock draft, and we're going to talk about the first round of the 2026 draft, because we did learn about the draft lottery during the winter meetings when I got to say a quick hello to you. And it looks like we're going to have a very interesting top and just a very interesting draft in general, I would say, right, in terms of talent. This is when the conversations really start to heat up, because now we know who's picking where.
We know who's picking where. The slam dunk right now, way, 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 way too early, number one pick is Rock Chulosky, UCLA shortstop. That's easy. Like, that is, I would say that many of the viewers could have predicted that. But Jacob, the other thing I do think it's worth noting with this is this feels like the clearest number one we've had probably since Adley Rutschman in 2019. But this is a reasonably deep top of the draft where I guess I'll ask you is, how surprised would you be if we roll around to July and Rock's not the number one pick and someone else has kind of emerged as that clear number one, or at least as a muddy number one? How about that? There's a possibility of a muddy number one that's not Rock.
You know, is there a possibility that we end up seeing a number one pick who's not Rock Chulosky? Of course. And I think that it matters like signability and money and all those things will come into play at the top of the first round that could ultimately influence the order. Do I think that there's somebody out there right this second who clearly emerges as a better first overall candidate or best draft prospect in the 26 class? No, I don't think so. And the feedback would suggest that that's kind of the sentiment across the industry right now. Chulosky was the sixth ever player to win Baseball America's College Player of the Year award in his non-draft eligible year last year. He's the odds-on favorite to go into the season as the preseason player of the year. And if he holds through and wins at the end, he'll be the first player ever to win back-to-back College Player of the Year awards. That's not a conversation that happens with just every player. And so I think that he has already created a fair degree of separation between himself and whoever's in that second to fifth category. And I'm not sure that it's a gap that can be easily closed, if closed at all.
Wow. Okay. Do we even have like a short list of contenders? Yeah.
So this is where this does get interesting, right? Like, this is also a good high school class at the top. This is one that we've been hearing about for a number of years. However, this is where this gets really fascinating. If you said, okay, if you look over past history, it's been a long, long time since we've had a college shortstop at the top of the draft who's kind of a slam dunk to go one or two. And the kind of the long-term scouting adage of that is those guys don't make it to college, right? Bobby Witt Jr. isn't going to be a great college shortstop because Bobby Witt Jr. gets signed and goes on. And and probably is up in the majors in case of Bywood Jr. before he would even have been draft eligible coming out of a four-year school. So you have kind of the Grady Emerson, you have the Jacob Lombards who are in this discussion, and we'll see how that kind of shakes out. Like the thing that we know about this Jacob is when you get to the top of these drafts, when you get to, you know, pick two, when you get to pick three, when you get the Rays and Twins or picking Rays pick two, the Twins pick three, these players all get kind of overanalyzed. It's kind of the way you have to do this. I do think that that will be an interesting discussion, an interesting debate is, okay, like what is the upside? Again, Rock's incredible, but at the same time, if you go back, Trey Turner, Alex Bregman, Dansby Swanson, those are really kind of like the best college shortstops of the last, I would say, 12, 15 years. Obviously, those guys are mostly in their 30s now. It's not a demographic that usually spits out the number one pick as much as it spits out a whole lot of picks who go in the top, you know, 10, 15, 20 spots in the draft.
Well, right, and that's what makes Rock so rare. He has such an enticing blend of skills between the ability to make a ton of contact. He hits the ball with authority when he does make contact. I think one of the more important things here is that he is a comfortably plus defender at shortstop. No matter who you ask, they'll tell you that he is, if not the best defender in this class overall, then certainly the best defender at his position. He has the kind of profile that remains at the top of the board. To go back and answer your question, Scott, I think it's interesting to look at this college pitching class as well. That's a demographic that has hit really big for teams in the last couple of years. We've seen these really quick promotions for arms that are successful in the minors and have more advanced stuff. I think there are three guys in particular at the top of this draft who fit that description. Liam Peterson from Florida, who is our number one starting pitcher overall at the moment in this year's class. Cameron Flukie at Coastal Carolina, who threw over 100 innings for a team that went to the national championship. And then Jackson Flora from UC Santa Barbara is somebody who I think will have a chance to really push up just the same way that Tyler Bremner did and took a deal to go number two overall, became the highest draft pick in Gaucho's history last year. His former number two starter has an opportunity now to really do the exact same thing. If he's willing to take a deal, the question becomes how high can he go? So this draft does come with some really intriguing options behind Rock Chulowski. Derek Curiel is another guy, college center fielder who plays great defense, really good contact bat. It was at the top of LSU's fall roster this year. So listen, there are candidates that make a lot of sense and who I think will make good prospects. But again, I don't know that there's as complete a package as you're going to get in Rock Chulowski just based on what we know at this point prior to getting into the spring.
Right. I would say that we're saying that right now, the very likely number one pick in July is Rock Chulowski. Now, again, you mentioned the pitchers. The other thing is worth mentioning kind of from a couple of years ago is we aren't that far removed from at this time we would have been talking about the Pirates have won the number one pick. Who's that going to be? And at this point we would be talking right now, Paul Skeens at that point was an Air Force transfer who had looked really good in fall ball, and it looked like he was going to only pitch now and not really focus on DHing anymore or hitting. So, you know, things can change, but that's obviously a pretty rare one that Paul Skeens goes from being a two-way player at Air Force to being the undisputed number one ace in all of college baseball while dominating all the way through, through Omaha. It can happen. I would say that you could probably say if you took the under on that happening again, I think you'd probably be pretty safe.
Yeah, it takes a real out. Go ahead, Jacob.
Just one quick thing. I think it's important to note the uncertainty going into the spring with Paul Skeens is different than what we have at the top of this draft as well. Skeens was a transfer, to your point, JJ. So teams didn't necessarily know how is this going to translate to the SEC. He was impressive in the fall, but that doesn't really mean anything when guys are facing their roommates. This order at the top of the draft right now includes no transfers from mid-majors to high majors. There are a couple of guys who move from high major to high major, and the rest of the guys are already ready-made high major products. They're going to be in their second or third year at the SEC, ACC level. So different from 2023, this is a draft class that has a little bit more track record to it. And I think that helps with the clarity that we're seeing at the top of the board. There's a defined number one prospect. He's already done it at the school that he's at. And there aren't any of these big changes like an Air Force to LSU jump that need to kind of smooth out over time and give more details that way. This group doesn't have that. There's less uncertainty in that regard.
And hey, we've got White Sox fans now very dialed into this conversation for the next 6 months or so. And they were boxed out of that conversation not long ago. So they're back in the lottery. It worked out really well for them. We'll keep it going, of course. Best draft coverage over at baseballamerica.com. There's an interesting rule change that is taking place under the radar in minor league baseball connected to major league organizations. We'll go to that next.
For all the parents out there with teenagers like Kratz, we know life's a little crazy.
Yeah, Cash App's here to not add to the craziness. They're here to help.
Yeah, Kratz, Cash App is designed to meet teens aged 13 to 17 where they are with intuitive educational tools. Available through sponsorship by an eligible parent or guardian, teens gain access to a personalized Cash App card. With the Cash App card, you and your teen's balances receive 24/7 fraud monitoring, and if something ever feels off, you have the ability to lock their card right from your phone in just one tap. Download Cash App and get started today. For a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code FAMILY10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners, prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, direct deposit and promotions provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures. Hey, JJ, you know I like to point guard on this show, but I'm actually just going to pass the rock pretty quickly here. So, you know, Cyrus put an article out in The Athletic about how Major League Baseball is essentially clamping down on how much creative freedom you have in terms of the tech and the data that is being collected at minor league parks. Was that a good setup here?
That is a good setup. And understandably, if you're hearing this, you know, we're going to have our own piece. I'm working on a piece for us, a follow-up on this for Baseball America. But if you're listening to this as a fan and you say this is owners trying to be cheap, you are 100% accurate. There's a – that MLB owners, to be honest, they do love socialism in some ways. They are – that there is a – hey, you know, what we don't want – we there's a competitive balance component to this. And so the good news, bad news of this, depending on how you look on this, is – that at the major league level, this is already kind of true. I'm not saying that there's not tech that some teams can have when it comes to biometric tracking, you know, motionless marker, you know, capture and all that. There is some tech that some teams have gone more into and some have gone less. But we've seen the example over the last really now going back to 2008. And then if you say with full player tracking 2015, where at the MLB level, this has all been standardized, right? Everyone has to have kind of the same tech suite and it's shared across all teams. And so I'm going to kind of point out that you like make the case, you know, again, there are pluses and minuses to this, but if you're a fan hearing this and you say, give me a reason why I might want this, it's like, well, okay, you can call this the Rockies rule if you want, which is there are teams who have fallen very far behind, I would say, when it comes to a lot of this tech at the minor league level, you know, and the Rockies are the one when you ask around that kind of comes up most notably on that. But at the major league level, imagine if over the last 15 to plus years now, all this pitch data, all this EV data and all at the major league level was something that some teams had and some teams didn't. And let me just tell you, Jacob can say just as well as I can how much that has become kind of core to how teams evaluate and how teams, you know, when I say evaluate players, I'm thinking at the major league level as well, right? This is the data that is now the language of the sport. And can you imagine if at the major league level, the Dodgers had this, you know, and the Astros had this and 15 teams hadn't really even kind of gone down the road or 10 or five, you could say, well, those would be teams that just aren't really trying. There would be a fair component of that. But at the same time, I do think that we would be seeing kind of the disparity between teams even widen. And there is some thought, you know, when I've tried to reach out to a couple of people today about this, Kyle Bodie has a tweet kind of thread out about this as well that kind of makes this point, which is if you think like that, the Dodgers have their own tech incubator. You know, the Dodgers are a team that says if it could help us, we're interested. And you have a whole lot of other teams who I would say look at it and say, how much is it going to cost? Well, let's let everyone else figure out if it's worthwhile to do first. With that being the case, we are seeing kind of a widening gap between the haves and have-nots here. This decision will have, you know, it will stifle innovation probably in some ways, but it also will reduce or at least stop the widening of the gap between the tech haves and have-nots when it comes to minor league baseball.
Yeah.
I'll say this as well. You know, I think with the, we don't know where this is headed definitively yet, but the word on the street and what coaches at the college level in particular are expecting is that once this new CBA gets negotiated, that the draft could ultimately end up shrinking, as could the minor league levels. We could lose a level at least of minor league baseball. That's what college coaches are operating under at the moment. If that is to happen, and Major League Baseball has already made it reasonably clear they want to offload a lot of the development to the college level, I don't see how this doesn't end up pushing some more top prospects or even more fringy prospects down to the college level, A, because there's just less room, but B, this could get to a point now, depending on how all of this shakes out, where colleges are more technologically advanced than some of their minor league counterparts. We are already seeing, especially in the ACC, teams are bringing in some of the high-level technology that Major League Baseball teams have been using as resources to help make their players better. That's the Traject machine that just got over to the North Carolina campus, for example. They're the first college team to have one of those machines. Is that going to be something that uniformly exists in minor league baseball? I guess we'll see now. And so depending on how that all goes down, are colleges a better developmental ground, especially relative to the lower minors, than maybe they would have been a couple years ago? Because there is a chance now that those teams will be in a position to have more tools at their disposal to make players better.
I will say that that's actually a point that has been used in a couple of different things that we've seen in the minor leagues. One thing that's just kind of been true for a long time is you're going to see some of that innovation come from the college, and I would say also the training facility level instead of MLB in a lot of cases. The way it has been described to me, which makes a lot of sense, is that there's just so many fewer boxes you have to check to get approval, to get to a yes, right? So at the college level, for instance, if you have a new piece of tech or a new technology suite that could really help a team, or you can, and you can make that case, your sales pitch really is directed to the head coach. And if they have the funding to do it, that's a yes, let's go forward with it. With Major League Baseball teams, often it's you have to get different departments to all sign off, right? Even if you have the kind of like the GM says, I think this is a good idea, then you'll have the sports science department, and then you'll have the, you know, the scouting department, the player development department, you know, you have all these different groups who kind of, and a lot of times are kind of competing for resources with a lot of teams. And so it's a little bit more difficult to innovate a lot of times at the major league club level than it is at the amateur level, because there's just less people involved, especially when you're talking about things that are let, like when it comes to Traject machines and things, there are seven figure outlays for some of these things. That's not going to be innovated usually at a college level, although in some cases at the major programs it can. But when you talk about things like, you know, the $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 level, which is a lot of tech in baseball, those are things that a lot of times kind of bubble up from underneath. Because those places can kind of make those decisions quicker than the MLB clubs can. But this is going to be interesting to see kind of, this will also create, when you have competing tech, kind of a haves and have nots, you know, because we've seen, like when it came to pitch tracking, there were a variety of companies that were all kind of going down the pitch tracking route. And well, you know, when Major League Baseball says we're going to be Hawkeye, well, then Hawkeye is kind of the winning one at the professional level in this way. When you now talk about that, that'll be at the major and the minor league level when they kind of settle on kind of a more defined tech suite. A lot of this, I think a lot of this is to do with the biomechanics that is now a key part of the game. And that's one other thing I will point out. There still will be competitive advantages here, even if you standardize the suite. We've seen this with the pitch tracking. We've seen this with hitting data, right? Like having the data is step one. Knowing how to then process the data, because these are talking about in some cases massive data sets, petabytes of data, is step two. But the most important step is having really smart people to then develop insights from that data. That's step three. And that is something where some teams just have, you know, better suites of people working on this than others. And that's going to be the part that it will maybe be flattened a little bit by this, but it still will be true that the teams that really invest in people to use this data will do a lot more than teams who don't.
I'm admittedly pushing the college game very aggressively here, but one thing I'll also say is imagine a world where college baseball, or at least the top of it, has better technology than some of the minor league baseball teams that are out there due to rules that limit what teams can have in-house. So you have that going for college baseball. The second thing that I'll say is the viability of the path from college baseball to the major leagues is outstanding right now. We've never seen more college alumni getting to the big leagues within 2 years than we've seen over the course of the last 3 years. And I think that that's relevant. If you have an opportunity to go and be developed in front of great technology that you know major league teams wanted to and have used in the past, then why not go to college? It is going to put guys at the top of the game quicker at this stage than it has previously. Yes, JJ.
Here's my answer to you. And this is where it's going to be interesting to see with all the talk about reduction of minors potentially happening, all that. Because if you are a high school player talented enough and you go straight to pro baseball, you will make $100 to $200 million more maybe in your career. Because the way that you sign the largest free agent contracts is you become a free agent at 25, 26, 27. And it is much easier to do so as a high school signee than it is as a college. If they ever do try to take high school, like push everyone to college and say, we're not going to have high school signees anymore, the MLBPA, if they're smart about it, would really be, look askance at that. Because if you look at the highest paid players in baseball, almost without exception, there's always a couple of exceptions, but the general rule is they are international and high school signees, because starting your clock earlier makes such a big difference in free agent contracts.
And sure, we're seeing, one thing I'll say, JJ, there are more high school players that are going to need to end up in college because of
right. But that's not where you're. We're talking about the top end, is what I'm just saying. Before we move on to the next one, we're just talking about the top end, though. If you are Bobby Witt Jr., if you are players like that, you will lose $50 to $100 million by going to college.
Sure.
Yeah, and if you're a business and you're trying to get involved, now you're going to have to basically pitch to MLB, and they'll probably want a piece of the business. That's what I think will happen too in terms of approval. You can't just pitch to a team, you got to pitch to the whole league. So anyway, to be continued, let's hit the final sprint. All right, we've got a little jump. Sendai Universities, and I'm going to butcher this because I've just gone from show to show for hours. Do you guys have it? You have
Go
the
ahead,
name?
Jacob. Go ahead. Try, no. Jacob. You're the one who wrote the story.
Geez, I think it's... Jinai Sato. So I just got thrown under the bus there. I butchered that for sure. But last name Sato, I'm very confident.
Okay. And so he's going to the U.S. He's going to be draft eligible. And he's like, nope, not going to enter the NPB world. How big is this?
It seems like a pretty big deal. I mean, we're seeing that there are a lot more Japanese amateurs who want to be eligible for the draft quicker and or be eligible at all for the American draft period and be able to play American baseball quicker. And this is a really good talent. From what I've heard, again, this is news that is just hours old, so I'm still digging in on it. We're talking about a guy who's very athletic. He has track record against American college players over the summer with the Japanese collegiate national team. Struck out 6 in 4 1/3 innings, allowed just 1 run. He was serving as their closer. Struck out guys like Rock Chalowski, Drew Burris, Eric Becker, all names who are going to be at the top of the 2026 draft on the college hitter side. And now he's coming to the United States. This is a path that we have seen some others take. Rintaro Sasaki was the most notable. Kenny Ishikawa, who's at Georgia, was last year at Seattle, is another name who's going to be eligible for the 2026 draft. Except the difference here is that this is somebody who comes over with a 97, 99 mile per hour fastball. He's got a plus splitter from the early evaluations of it that he throws up to 92 miles per hour. And there's a slider in there. So it's somebody with first round upside, who kind of continues to go along this trend of getting to America quicker and being eligible for the draft. It is a huge deal for college baseball.
I'm going to be interested, like you said, this is something where we're seeing now, this is one guy, three, you're starting to see a trend. I do kind of worry, like, again, as someone who also does care about the MPB, like if we do see a lot of this, this is obviously a little bit of a talent drain that's coming on here, because the rules as they are currently set up basically very strongly encourage foreign players, not just Japanese, Korean, Cuban, whoever, if you're a professional, foreign professionals, to play over there till you're age 25 and play 7 years to then be an MLB free agent. Obviously, the draft is a little different, but at the same time, like Jacob said, this does kind of start your clock as far as you can get drafted. You can get a decent bonus that way and then start your free agent clock a little bit earlier as well without having to spend 7 years in a foreign league before you come to the – if your dream is playing Major League Baseball, this gets you to Major League Baseball quicker.
It's like the opposite of what Shohei Ohtani did, for example, or Roki Sasaki, right? You go into the system and you kind of hurt yourself for long-term potential earnings. Shohei is a unique character. I think he's going to be fine financially, but just putting it in context.
It's truly the opposite of what Carter Stewart did, because remember that was about six years ago, there was this thought, oh, this is the loophole, is go to Japan and then come over as a free agent. And the reality of it is that going to Japan for seven seasons is not really a loophole. It's an open door if you want to do it, but you are committing to playing in Japan for a very long time, as Carter Stewart, who was a 2018 first round pick, is kind of evidence of. It's not a easy like, oh, this is a loophole. This is more of a loophole because you can come over to the U.S., play a few years of college baseball, and then jump right into the MLB draft. That's more of a loophole than going to Japan for 7 years.
Exactly. Interesting story. And yes, it's fresh. So expect more on baseballamerica.com. That's it for us this week. We're back next week. We'll keep rolling. We'll keep going over whatever's happening news-wise. Yes, it has been a very busy time period and a lot of things will probably happen. My guess is our show next week will be breaking down prospect acquisition via trades that maybe happen over the next week before there is like a mini holiday break for some front offices that like to chill. All right, we'll see you then.